I think we're on. Yes, we're on. It's great to have everyone here. We're doing another session on the JFK Assassination Files release, and I'm joined by Alexandra Bruce from Forbidden Knowledge TV. It's good to see you, Alexandra.
Hello.
It's interesting. There's been all kinds of things going on about these files, so we're going to get into some of the meat of the action. But I will also say that the way the media is handling the release of these files is absurd. And they're going back to really, Warren Commission thinking, and KGB did it, and a lot of BS like that. And now they're trying to do these distraction ops. One of the ones that they recently ran actually was about Martin Luther King's sex life. That has nothing to do with the JFK assassination, and nor do we care about it. What we care about is the.
It was a smear campaign at the time. It's
Right.
a fake. They're releasing it. That's odd.
It is. It
But
is.
I think it's a way to maybe throw Trump under the bus again because it just, Trump is
Yeah.
ordering release these things and oh, it's a thing that smears, MLK, whatever.
Right. Yeah, there's no question about it. I also think that maybe this little distraction op that they're doing, there's another file they released which said, ooh, Oswald in Mexico City met with Kostikov, who was a KGB assassin and all this stuff. First of all, that's ancient history. And second of all, Oswald, there's no evidence that he ever even went to Mexico City. So it's another red herring that they're very happy to put out there. But I find it's interesting the things that they cherry pick and choose and actually, have out. In the grand scheme of things,
It
it's
was
very
also,
small.
people were talking about this Mexico trip to look forward to documents about the Mexico trip
Right.
before the documents were released. So even the people who are supposed to be students of this are trying to herd us into that direction. I find that, strange. I'm not saying, the
Yeah.
people in the mainstream media are saying, oh yeah, look out for the stories about Oswald in Mexico City and things like this. What I'm being told by real hardcore students of the JFK assassination is that this story is a complete fabrication. They did not
Yeah,
know.
it makes sense. It makes sense because, first of all, there's no photos of Oswald in Mexico City. That's pretty telling. There's no audio of him, and the witnesses are all over the place. One of them has him as a blonde guy who's 6 foot tall. So that's obviously not Oswald. The other thing I think is very interesting when we look at this is the Mexico City incident is important somehow in the building of the story because it says Oswald went to Mexico City and he wanted to get a passport to go to Cuba. And we know that they're always trying to make him into this Cuban revolutionary. And these are part of the ops that he participated in also when he was in New Orleans. So we are looking at something there. I can't imagine for the life of me the CIA's camera's not working just when the guy who's going to assassinate the president shows up. It doesn't make any sense. It's a phony story. There's no evidence for Oswald in Mexico City at all. So I think that's another distraction op.
Yes.
You get that impression?
Oh, absolutely.
But it is fascinating because this starts to build more of that linkage. So when they had Oswald in the summer of '63 doing those television shows, saying he was a Marxist and all that. While he was working for Bannister, who was a ex-FBI right-wing guy down there and infiltrating student groups and things like that. Now, this ties in very interestingly with something else that he was doing, which was he was up against this right-wing group who he supposedly had infiltrated and pretended to go along with them. And then they see him protesting for Castro and free Castro, free Cuba. And it's pretty interesting because what happens is those people go on such a tear against Oswald. As a matter of fact, when the assassination happens, this group, this anti-Castro Cuban group called the DRE, which was definitely part political operation and part psychological operation, they run a full-page ad of Oswald saying that he was guilty of the assassination, which I found really unusual. But something that comes into play here is there's a lawsuit pending now, which is Jefferson Morley, who's the former Washington Post journalist. And the the lawsuit states that the CIA hid the records about the person who was running this operation for the DRE and giving them money and all this stuff because the CIA had never disclosed him before. His name is George Janitis. Now, in my own research, I came across a very interesting picture, and I want your reaction to this. I'm going to see if it shows up here. But this is a picture of Janitis. He's the shorter guy here. And the guy next to him is Admiral Deputy CIA Director Bobby Inman.
Right.
Bobby Ray Inman. Now, anyone who's used to the UFO topic will definitely be aware of Inman, his unusual sort of public statements about UFOs and how we had used reversed engineered technology and things like that were leaked, quote unquote. And that was at the end of the 80s. And he has a very unusual interest in the topic. And here he is shaking hands with someone who basically the CIA said didn't exist. And he's giving him a career commendation, a career achievement commendation. Now, Janitis also has one other very interesting credit, which is that he was the liaison between the House Assassinations Committee that was investigating the murder of President Kennedy in the 70s after the Warren Commission. That's the same commission that came to the conclusion that JFK was killed in a probable conspiracy, basically throwing out the Warren Commission conclusion, which the media still uses. And they don't refer to the House Assassinations Committee, which is very odd considering that was an actual more updated, you know, 10 years, 15 years later. But interestingly enough, Janitis, as the liaison, as the front man between the two, one of the rules that the Congressional Committee had set up was that Janitis and someone like him who was around in 1963 and an active agent could not be involved in the process of working with Congress and CIA files. Well, they put Janitis in there and they said didn't say anything about his activity in 63. So they definitely got caught in a lie there, and Morley put the case in, and it was Professor Scott and David Talbot, who was the editor at Salon, who supported Morley in that. And Morley's been rejected a few times in court over this, but he's still going for the records. Interestingly enough, the Janitis records aren't even part of what we're talking about with the release of the rest of these files. They're not in there. It's a separate thing because they weren't considered because nobody knew Janitis was running the psychological operation involving Oswald.
So that'd be very interesting to see if there's anything else besides just what Morley's suing for.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's going to tell us, first of all, that not only is the CIA aware of Oswald, but they're actively setting up an operation against him, probably to make him look even more left-wing because they're supporting a right-wing group outing him. So it's a very unusual operation, and I think Janitis' history, you know, 13 years later showing up for the House Assassinations Committee as the liaison between the CIA and the Congress on the JFK assassination is very unusual. And then we have him with Inman. So, you know, and Inman, he's basically reporting to his boss there because Inman is deputy CIA director, and that picture's from 1981. So this is the Reagan administration. So we know that in the Reagan administration, we have this whole Star Wars SDI push, which is the weaponization of space. But is it a cover basically for something else beyond just the Soviet Union? And this has been an ongoing question. But I think it's fascinating because when we really look at that period, we find that something that we had called continuity of government, COG planning, which had been in place since the 50s, and I'm doing a series on this called SSP and COG, that they changed the rules. And there was actually a television special about this in the 80s, that they changed the rule around COG, that it wasn't just for a nuclear emergency, which is what it was originally set up for under the national security state rules in the 50s, in case we had a nuclear exchange with Russia back then. We had a gigantic underground government bunker set up. But they changed the rule so that the term was emergency, no longer nuclear emergency. They took that out. And then all of a sudden, we have all this unusual activity in space. And we've got Star Wars and SDI. And what I've deduced from going through carefully the work that Peter Dale Scott, the professor at Berkeley, and other work, like Joseph Farrell's work, is that they've taken the rules of continuity of government at that point and they move them into outer space, so that's how that budget can go black. That's how it can be hard to trace. That's how when people say, well, how could you have a program that exists out in space that we're not aware of in addition to the NASA one? And the key to that is that it now falls under continuity of government planning, which, as we know, can disappear into a black hole and nobody can question it.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. Yeah, I think it's a very key identification that you've made there between continuity of government and the secret space program, absolutely, and its relationship to SDI, whatever it's called today.
Good point. I know. What did it morph into? One thing's kind of fascinating. The UFO wave that comes in the 90s is post the Star Wars push, and it's post the Gorbachev era and all that stuff that came up. But in that 90s period, there was that very unusual case where all these people had witnessed an unusual sighting and abduction scene in New York City. And one of them was a UN ambassador. And but you know a lot about this story. And can you give us a little bit on that one?
Yeah, I actually was living, I was living there at the time. And this was basically, it's the story that's covered in the Bud Hopkins book, Witnessed, that came out in 1994. The story itself happened in 1989.
Right.
And it happened somewhere in Lower Manhattan, right next to the Brooklyn Bridge, where there is sort of like a housing development. It's not, it's like a lower income housing. It's not like a, not like the bottom of the barrel housing.
Right.
Anyway, so a woman named Linda Cortile lived on one of the top floors there, and numerous witnesses on the Brooklyn Bridge, on the FDR that goes up and down the East River in Manhattan, from their cars witnessed what appeared to be a UFO hovering just outside of this, I don't know, approximately 20-story building. There are maybe six of them, mm-hmm. in a red brick. And everyone saw this woman getting floated out of the window in her white nightgown and sucked into the bottom of this ship. And apparently UN Secretary Paris de Cuellar was among these witnesses, and his whole security detail, and apparently two FBI agents as well, who were maybe part of the security detail, I'm not sure. But this was while he was on his way to a meeting with the Prince of Liechtenstein, mm-hmm. Who was involved with the UN, which, Paris de Cuellar was the secretary at the time. And they were going to discuss UFO disclosure. And then this thing happens where he sees this woman getting sucked into the bottom of a ship in her nightgown.
Wow.
And so this was the story. Bud Hopkins regressed her and did this very in-depth story. She wrote, she apparently had a lot of weirdness going on in her life at that time, and wrote her own book about it that was called The X Cycles, you know, self-published. The craziest books I've ever read in my life. for anyone who's been around weirdness with UFOs, it's classic. It is exactly the kind of thing that
happens. For you to say that's pretty hardcore. You've written some of the wild ones.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, this is out there. It's out. Because she ends up, you know, you hear the story with Bud Hopkins. He talks about these two FBI agents contacted him to tell him, yes, we are witnesses and we saw this thing happen with Paris de Cuellar. And at the time, Bud was withholding Paris de Cuellar's name. He would just say that he was with the UN. Now, you know, 20 years later, we're hearing Stephen Greer's version of the story. And we're hearing this, that actually Paris de Cuellar was on his way to like a late meeting at night with what's his name, Eric, whatever, the Prince of Liechtenstein, to talk mm-hmm. about, you know, we're going to do this. And this was it was during Herbert, you know, the first Bush presidency, and GHW, and they were, this was sort of carried over from things that Reagan had started Gorbachev to do UFO disclosure. But so many weird things happened also in Kennebunkport subsequent to that, to the Brooklyn Bridge event, at this president's summer house in Maine, there were UFOs buzzing the house all summer long, and they were freaked out. They were freaked out into submission. Now, what Stephen Greer says is that all of these events in Kennebunkport and Brooklyn Bridge were very advanced mind control. That these people literally had, the witnesses had these things inserted into their brain. Maybe there was some kind of holographics, light work, you know.
There had to be something.
But basically their brains were all like entrained with some kind of an electromagnetic device to see the same thing and to report.
Unbelievable.
He says technology is beyond belief, and it was even 89.
It's a wild story. That's the thing about it.
Every which way you look at it.
it's truly incredible. So he's, what role did he play to Boutros Ghali, who was the head of the UN?
Paris de Cuellar. I was wrong. It was Paris de Cuellar, not Ghali.
Okay. So,
which I guess won right before Boutros Ghali.
Right. So
the point is that they were on their way to have a late night meeting to discuss how they were going to do UFO disclosure. And this thing happens that was orchestrated by, you know, some kind of other, you know, the deep state that didn't want it to stay secret. And so...
Well, it's interesting because this is the first go-round of UFO disclosure. You know, and it's an unsuccessful one, as it turns out, in the 90s, because, you know, it's an interesting context that something like that is even allowed to happen. But we had unusual cases that were very widespread, like Gulf Breeze and the Phoenix Lights and all these things. And it was really like the reality of this stuff was closing in. And, you know, this is where you have the culture being prepared for it. You have shows like The X-Files out there.
Absolutely. You have this whole wave of books being published by Bud Hopkins, by John Mack. And then her first name, Linda Cortile, her pseudonym as a writer was Mia something. And the book was called X-Cycles. And yes, she had a house somewhere in that Gulf Breeze area also. And that's where much of her book took place, where... Did I finish telling the story? It was absolutely nuts. She ended up having an affair with one of those FBI agents who had been following her around after. And then it turns out that he was her son.
Whoa.
That was her story. But not only that, he was her hybrid abduction son.
Did they force her to lose it maybe because her story was so radioactive?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this... It's hard to tell. I mean, because
that's a good way to put it. You know. It is hard to tell. When you get into that level, it's very hard.
Oh, absolutely, because you have Bud Hopkins' version and Linda Cortile's version, which was that it was real. There was an abduction that took place in Lower Manhattan. Now, the Stephen Greer version is that no, this was all an implant. This was all a some kind of an electro brainwave entrainment event that was perpetrated on the people who were driving on the Brooklyn Bridge, the FDR, underneath the FDR, including Paris de Cuellar.
Does Greer ever say why they did that?
Yeah, it was to affect that meeting and to make them choose not to do disclosure at that time. That's what...
So it was like a big spook operation.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned Greer, because the guy that they're trotting out so hardcore right now around the JFK files release is our friend James Woolsey, who is the former CIA director and very unusual character. And he was under Clinton, actually, interestingly enough. So he says that, one of the things that Greer says about him is, and I find it very odd, by the way, as an aside, that they are rolling out him instead of some other former CIA director. Apparently they want his kind of cover job. But again, he has a weird relation to UFOs, and we'll get into that. Now, but when we look at Woolsey, his story about Greer is that he was at some big event somewhere, and Greer happened to be at the event. And Greer's story is, I briefed him for 3 hours on UFOs. So I don't know, there's no substantiation behind it. And then again, it could have been that somebody like Woolsey reached out to Greer and said, give me some information on this, but as soon as Greer went out and made it public, you know, they denied the whole thing. Or Greer just made it up. It's hard to say. What do you think?
It's impossible. I mean,
it's a tricky one, isn't it? Yeah. I always thought it's weird because, of course, every Greer presentation, it's Woolsey. He always mentions this Woolsey thing. And Woolsey flat out denies it. So it's a weird one. Of course, the CIA is quite good at denying things, as we know. Now, there's something in this whole wave when we get into the 90s that I think is fascinating, because the first big block around the UFO question is, the first big block would be all the way back, but I just mean in the kind of semi-modern era is the 60s. And then the 70s are kind of like the open up period, because you have Jimmy Carter saying, well, let's go ahead and open up the FOIA requests on UFO files. And most of the UFO documents that we have now come from that period. As a matter of fact, some of the documents, I found this fascinating, some of the documents that came out in the 70s have been reclassified.
That's very...
So, I mean, how do you do that?
What's interesting is how Hollywood was sort of getting in on that action. And, you know, it really is the sort of thing that makes you think that absolutely... Hollywood is part of the whole propaganda machine of the government, because the movies that were coming out were very much, there was Star Wars, I think, in 1975, and then in 77 it was Close Encounters.
Right.
Which really was a revolutionary film at the time. You know, it was about abduction, basically. I mean, and he's interfacing with humans in a way, in an encounter, you know, it had always been, you know, like B-movie sci-fi killing aliens. But this was like the friendly alien in the closet, you know, story.
Well, that's a good way to put it, actually. Yeah.
Or there was that, too. There was that, too.
Well, check this out. There's this period there that you're referring to in the 70s. And then the 90s is another kind of period like that, where they're starting to get us ready for this whole thing. And I
Absolutely.
Feel like
it was everywhere. That's when the whole great alien thing happened.
Yes.
You know, and it became, because if you remember, I was at part of a conference about this. It was hilarious. If you look at sort of the pop culture representation of aliens in the beginning of the century, I mean, if you look, Superman was an alien. He was from Krypton, right? Mm-hmm. He was a superhero. And this sort of idea of aliens as being supermen persisted in the comic book world for at least through the 50s and 60s. And then they started to be, there were some monster ones, you know, that were depicting, you know, that were coming over to take over the world. Only in the 90s when this very pervasive thing about grays started happening. In the pop culture.
Yes.
And has completely replaced everybody's idea of what an alien is supposed to be.
Right. If you go into the 60s and 50s, you're dealing with beautiful blonde, blue-eyed.
Yeah, Nordics. Yeah. Whites.
Whites, yeah, the whites.
All white.
There's weird stories out there, though. And, you know, if we go further on UFOs, we're going to be here all night, because it gets more and more fascinating. But one of the things and the trends that I see are these kind of elder statesmen of UFO things in the 70s. So we had J. Allen Hynek, you know, and we're looking at these guys and thinking, well, maybe, you know, they have the kind of gravitas to bring the issue home. And then you go into the 80s and smack down again, right? You've got space wars and that whole thing with SDI and Reagan and all the rest of it. Things get very real. And they're dealing with a real UFO threat in their mind, or they're trying to deal with it. And that gets into a lot of like Philip Corso's version of events. But one thing that I think is interesting is when you go into the 90s, again, you have this elder statesman thing with Mack and kind of with Hopkins in a way.
Trying to give respect and real. And then apparently underground, but we're listening, you know, if we believe what Greer says, they were going to do disclosure in the late 90s or mid 90s.
Yes.
But then what happened then is 9/11 and, you know, the war in Iraq.
Right. So they get the culture off that beat. They decide it's almost like there's a war in what they call MJ-12. And we'll use that as a term for now. But that controlling group that handles the alien file there's some kind of an imbalance there, because whenever those forces come up to try to do it, and you have like Lawrence Rockefeller meeting the Clintons and the Clintons holding books about UFOs are real and things like that. And then you get into the Bush SmackDown era, and they're coming from a totally different place. I'm not saying that the Clinton era is, they're coming from a better place necessarily, but they're planning to move the culture into this UFO pose.
See who's associated with that. You have John Podesta, who's also very pro that.
Right, right. And it's very, very strange because he's an easily blackmailable character.
It's just like the ultimate distraction from his own stuff.
Right. Exactly. And it's interesting, as a little aside on blackmail, I found something very interesting in the recent JFK Files release that I wanted to read to everyone. And everyone knows Mark Lane, who was really the prominent, probably the prominent, especially in the beginning, JFK critic, JFK assassination critic of the Warren Commission, of the CIA, of the government's version of events. And really, Lane did incredible work. I don't think there was anybody who ever made as much of a dent the way that he did. He was a New York lawyer, and he actually had worked on one of the John Kennedy campaigns. And, you know, he became a controversial figure as time went on. But I think that he had to be the standout JFK researcher. And it turns out that there's a file that Judge Tunheim, and Tunheim was the head of the ARRB, which is the Assassination Record Review Board, in the 90s. And there's a request in there from Mark Lane to not let out a photograph of him in this kind of sexually compromised position. I found this interesting, not because of the private life of Mark Lane, but more because you wonder, when these people get to a certain level, what kind of assets are employed to make them blackmailable? What kind of control files do they have on these people to make them go up to the water's edge but not jump in? As it were, when it came to something as sensitive as the JFK assassination.
Yeah, good question.
I mean, it's interesting when we get into blackmail, and then when you mention Podesta, my mind sets off immediately. And of course, around the whole Podesta thing, we have these meetings, you know, with this burnout Blink 182 thing. And, you know, he's supposed to bring disclosure. And I'm going to tell you an interesting thing. Now, the person who's supposed to be advising him is this guy, Inman, again, and he's back. Now, how old is Inman? Inman's pretty old. What's he doing on the scene with this UFO thing again, and with the Blink 182 Tom DeLonge, you know, doing this kind of like, actually, it's a corporation for disclosure. I mean, really ridiculous stuff. And really perpetrating a public relations op on the public, and saying, hey, look, I've got all these CIA people behind me. It's an uncomfortable feeling. And then when we see Inman standing there with Janitis, and we still have a block on the JFK files 54 years later, these things are intersecting. You know, we're starting to see it exposed for what it is, which is the only way that they want to do any kind of UFO disclosure is under the program of the CIA. And that program, you know, definitely wouldn't be the real thing by any stretch of the imagination, but they are trying very hard to bring this up now and into the public view.
Yeah, it's incredible that Bobby Reyes is still out there. He's got to be at least, I would think, around 90 years old or something.
Absolutely. Well, how many deputy CIA directors do you know who have come out and said, We recovered technology from a crash retrieval, and that's where a lot of our technological innovation comes from, right? Corso is pretty much one of the few, but he wasn't a CIA deputy director. He was somebody who came out of the Foreign Technology Office. So I think we're looking at a very interesting picture. Now, something that's not mentioned about the files that didn't come out on the JFK side and how they're doing this rolling file release is the set of files that have to do with Jim Garrison. And there's 16 pages that's literally called CIA Secret Files on Garrison. You can't get any more obvious than that as a title. we know from Victor Marchetti's work that the CIA was actually engaged to take down a Garrison in his investigation of the JFK assassination, popularized in the Oliver Stone movie. That's where the Stone movie comes from, JFK. That's where we got the ARRB and the JFK Records Act that is giving us this release in the first place. So all these things kind of melt together. Now, here's the interesting thing. The files they won't release are related to the Garrison investigation. But what was the Garrison investigation getting close to? Well, he wasn't just getting close to a regular assassination plot and some rogue element of the CIA involved. Certainly that was an element of it. But Garrison was getting very, very curious about the aerospace wing of the military-industrial complex being involved in the assassination. And I think that's why they don't want to deal with those files and that they didn't want to deal with Garrison in the first place.
And I think it's, maybe you should read what Garrison actually wrote, because it's pretty.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's pretty disturbing. And one of the things that has always kind of floated around around JFK research is this Torbett document. And the Torbett document is something from a lawyer in Texas who apparently had worked with LBJ. And he decided to kind of investigate the entire thing. And that was, Torbett was a pseudonym, but he put out this thing. And for a long time, these were copies that were passed among researchers underground and things. Eventually, a book came out with all of the different Torbett documents in there. And that, I think, really outlines that it was basically an underground NASA plot, that it involved UFO technology and covering it up, which we've seen dramatic trails. Even my interview with Douglas Caddy, who's the former Watergate lawyer, he came forward and said that E. Howard Hunt had told him the reason JFK was assassinated was because he was going to give our most vital secret, national security secret, away to the Soviets and disclose to the public. And Caddy asked him, what was it? And Hunt told him it was the alien presence. He wouldn't elaborate on it. But there's a major CIA figure giving the actual reason for it. I think it's kind of the biggest bombshell, in the last decade around this entire topic, because this is not a CIA smokescreen, because Caddy was really good friends with Hunt, you know, and he'd been a regular participant in family events. And when I talked to Hunt's son, he said that Caddy had really been around, you know, he'd really been close to the family. So Hunt telling him this before he went to prison, after getting him to represent, after getting Caddy to represent the Watergate burglars, just before he gets sent off to prison, Caddy says, why was JFK assassinated? And their interplay, their interchange is very unusual, because first, what he says is, you know, Caddy says, well, why were you in Watergate in the first place? What were you breaking in there for? What were you doing in there? And Hunt says, well, we were looking for these Cuban intelligence files that would implicate basically the Nixon administration in an older operation around the JFK assassination. It was in a plot to assassinate Castro, and that they used some of the same people. Now, what's interesting about this is Caddy decides to press him on the reason why they decided to assassinate Kennedy in the first place. That's when he comes back and says, well, he was going to give our most vital secret away, the alien presence. So we have a real historical figure in Caddy, who, as the Watergate lawyer, you know, he steps out of the pages of history to tell us this. He came forward after watching my documentary, Agent Oswald, and he contacted me and he said that it's correct. That was his first comment. And we got to talking, and eventually he decided that he was going to come forward with this. But I've always found that, you know, alien presence, this term, is really fascinating. But here is what Garrison had to say. In 1968, Garrison Telephone magazine editor Warren Hinkle to say this. Quote, important new evidence has surfaced. Those Texas oil men do not appear to be involved in President Kennedy's murder in the way we first thought. It was the military-industrial complex that put up the money for the assassination. But as far as we can tell, the conspiracy was limited to the aerospace wing.
Right, so we definitely have in Garrison and in Caddy two things that sort of line up.
Yeah. There. On that deep level. That's why when these JFK files come out and they say, hey, look, MLK had sex beach parties.
Yeah.
it's a smokescreen, because this is the kind of thing that they're actually afraid of, because they don't want people understanding why the aerospace wing would decide to eliminate President Kennedy. And that goes back to Kennedy's memo about UFOs and Kennedy's actions leading up to the assassination, where he's working with the Soviet Union. He's opting out of a space race into cooperation, and he wants to share this information. And of course, Hunt says to Caddy, he wants to share the alien presence. Well, if somebody has a hard time believing there's aliens, that's fine. But basically he's saying he wants to share the UFO secret. That's the way I interpret that. And that's something that they didn't want to do. Kennedy was saying, well, we can't have these things out there without them knowing about it, because if they don't have the reports that we have, if they don't have the same knowledge base, it might trigger a nuclear incident, which I think is just the kind of pragmatic thinking that that he would bring forward. So it's kind of fascinating, I think, when you look at it. You know, are we looking at the fact that the UFO phenomena, whatever it is actually the deciding factor in history that's bringing us to this point where we've gone through the assassinations, the national security state developments, and SDI Star Wars, and the redevelopment technologies? The whole thing is the entire structure set up in order to guard the secret of the UFO.
Yeah, I think so. I think all kinds of things have been distractions from that. And it seems coming back up. I don't know. It seems, you know, one wonders, you have to look also at the financing. A lot of the people who were involved with, especially in the 1990s push, it was really big. It was like, you couldn't escape from it. Like the pop culture was saturated with aliens and, you know, like all the shows, all the TV shows. It was like, there was the Next Generation, Star Trek, the Next Generation, and then like a competing franchise, another one of these space opera shows, and
right,
all of these books about abduction, and the X-Files came out, and they were really getting into this, and it was just everywhere you looked, it was the hot topic. And it seems like the only thing that made that go away was 9/11 and the war with Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like the war of Iraq was, you know, I mean, it certainly functioned that way. It got it out of the pop culture completely. It just went away.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to ask you a question which is really out there from one of your other books. And this had to do with your work on the Montauk book and an interview we did actually recently, which is coming out, called Real Stranger Things, because it's about the Montauk Project, which is, of course, where they Netflix lifted a lot of the ideas from to build one of their stories of this series. But one of the things that came up around Montauk is when you were investigating it, you talked to a couple of younger guys who are in the military who were saying, we're training, we're going to be training. They made a weird prediction about training for a war in 2003, but the year was something like 1998. Can you recall that?
Yeah, it was, I was interviewing two kids who claimed to be part of UFO retrieval groups.
Mm-hmm.
One was 19, the other one was 23 at the time, and this was like 1996, 97. And they were saying, yeah, we're training, you know, we get taken to some upside down kind of place, you know, like the parallel universe. They call it the upside
down. Familiar?
Yeah, Stranger Things. I mean, Stranger Things took it from a whole bunch of project stuff. And that they were training for a war in the desert that would begin in 2003. So back in, you know, late 96, 97, that we weren't going to go to war. I mean, we had already been at Desert Storm. It was over, and it didn't really seem like we were going to go back there, mm-hmm. go back to Iraq. It just didn't seem like, it wasn't on my radar.
No.
When we started invading Iraq, when the United States, you know, the coalition of the willing invaded Iraq in 2003, I definitely had the chills. I had the chills recalling what these kids had been telling me.
It's strange. That's such a strange story that they were able to predict it. And you also have a habit of showing up in the middle of these things.
Yeah, it's like I'm like a strangeness attractor of some kind. But the thing with Montauk, though, is that apparently it's on some kind of a wave where, what is it, like, it's on a cycle where strange things or significant things happen on the threes of every decade, and especially they culminate, and it, according to Preston Nichols, it has to do with the biorhythm of the Earth itself, which is exactly 20 years long. And it peaks on August 12th, and I guess the next one will be 2023. And I guess that will be a big one this time.
Yeah. So these are cycles that are related to what the Montauk Project did?
Right, yeah, because the Montauk Project happened in 83. And it corresponded to the Philadelphia Experiment in 1943. And so when these kids said 2003, it was part of that biorhythmic.
I think there's something to cycles. And there's something to be said for that because, you know, we have so much of the weird occult stuff around the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and developing the space program. And then Aleister Crowley is involved in that. And then in 1947, suddenly it's almost like a portal opens up and all these UFOs are everywhere. So there is something fascinating about timing and cycles. So I never discount that. I do think it's interesting that these guys made this prediction. Now I can share another prediction that happened that came true, which was very odd, which is when I was working for a technology magazine, I got a press release from a guy named Stan Fulham, who was an ex-NORAD officer. And he predicted that September of 2010, that in October of 2010, there was going to be a major sighting over New York City, and that this was a real kind of message and from these off-world civilizations. So then I didn't think much about it at the time because, you know, you do see a lot of predictions in UFO land, and they don't really come to pass generally. On October 13th, 2010, Stan Fulham's prediction came true, and there was a massive daytime sighting over New York City. And I've actually been working on a documentary about it, and I've been looking for witnesses to that sighting, although it was massively filmed by CBS News, which just happened to be setting up there as a film crew, and they were getting incredible footage of this thing. And I did talk to Stan before he died, and I discovered the source. Of course, Stan Fulham died 6 weeks after his prediction came true, which I found very odd. And but I tracked down his source, and that was also very, very interesting. It was a group. It was a guy who channeled a group of entities. He was actually a channel, and his name was Rick Thurston. And he was a fascinating person, and I spent 12 hours of recording him and the things that he was talking about in relation to these predictions. But that's very unusual that anyone can predict a sighting. And this is why I look at something like what you're telling me and I say, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at information like Montauk. But if somebody comes through and actually with that kind of information, then I think there is something special that they're tied into. And I try to listen a little bit deeper. In Stan's case, we never got to really understand what it was all about and what he was really saying with it, because he died so shortly after that. And I think when you talk, and I've spent time talking to UFO researchers, authors, and all these people, nobody really thinks twice about Stan Fulham or knows anything about him, which I find absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I've never heard of him before.
It's an amazing story, and it's going to be amazing the things that we put out about him. But I want to revisit this kind of SSP COG thing for a moment. So if there are people engaged in continuity of government planning, and if it has moved into space, and if we have now all of these private companies moving into space and the next major place to go is a space economy. You know, and we're seeing all these companies go in for space tourism, like Richard Branson's company. And, you know, SpaceX is doing their thing. So we're really on our way to a space economy, which means the things that we're seeing here on Earth, you know, a lot of the industries they don't have an opportunity to grow. They're looking for these growth opportunities in space, like Jeff Bezos made a comment to this effect. Interestingly enough, the Trump administration announced that they were reopening the Space Council, which is something that has been closed ever since it was first announced under Bush 1 and Dan Quayle. They did a big press release for it. Remember Dan Quayle?
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of hard to forget.
Deer in the headlights. He's the original deer in the headlights.
What was he doing there? We still don't know. But I do think it's fascinating. There's actually a very interesting chapter about Bush and Quayle wanting to go to Mars, and they put all this thing behind doing a manned mission to Mars, and it was this big push. And you get into Clinton's era, and that just all disappears because presumably they have this kind of Cold War windfall because it's over, and they just stop thinking about that. But it's really that all this development really goes black. So what we've been pumping into space under the black budget and the continuity of government rules, which stipulate that you don't have to reveal where any of that funding goes. I get into that and I look at the conversations that I had recently, for example, with the former HUD secretary, assistant HUD secretary, Catherine Austin Fitz, where she says, well, there's $21 trillion missing from HUD and DOD alone, never mind the rest of the government. So when you see that type of money disappearing and you see this big privatized space economy emerging, for me, it tells me that what we're looking at is this picture is moving into space one way or another.
Yeah. It's like a relentless juggernaut. It's insisting. And it's funny because my subscribers all don't believe, pretty much they all don't believe that it's possible to get past the Van Allen radiation belts. And they think it's all bullshit.
Well, there's a lot of different things about that. I think the reason that the moon hoax idea came up, and I think that's bogus, by the way, because I think not only have we been to the moon, we've been out there. But I understand where that Apollo hoax came from, because there were so many things that we hid when we got to the moon about things that we found there and, you know, structures, and about what we saw when we were out there about these other craft flying around, that I think there was a lot of sleight of hand going on the way it was described, and the way it was explained. It's a very controlled event. So there were some brilliant people who came forward and just talked about this, and they put out books about it, and they were brilliant. And they talked about how people who raised the subject and were going to do congressional committees about, you know, where did the money for Apollo go, and like, what was the technology used and all the rest of it, they would end up in car crashes and stuff. And it was very convincing. And the only problem with all the research that they had was that they were using the wrong conclusion, which is that the reason all that stuff happened was because we didn't go to the moon. Well, we certainly went to the moon. I don't think that's in any question. But what we found when we got there was not the kind of thing that you disclose to a public that you're trying to keep in the dark, you know, and keep them on a fossil fuel paradigm and all the rest of it, and living with rules that were, you know, good 100 years ago. So we've certainly been cut off from the technological juggernaut, I think. And this situation is moving on, and that's the impression I get.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you seen the self-landing rockets that SpaceX has? It's pretty, like, wow.
Well, it's interesting. In my recent interview with Fitz, she was telling me about, she was driving town to town, and what she's seeing is these spaceports are everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that technology is not really in place yet for those things to be active. So these people are getting the jump on it. But this is the kind of thing that we're moving into. And pretty quickly, I think, also. And I would also have to say that when you look at a space economy and, you know, this mineral asteroid mining stuff that goes on out there, there's incredible financial opportunities. So why wouldn't they be setting up this kind of thing? But I think it's problematic. Bless you. It's problematic because, you know, there's so much secrecy about it. We have no idea about what's out there. And I don't think they can really have us out there and, you know, living the vita loca out in space, doing space tourism and hanging out. You know, somebody's going to see these off-world craft. And as a result of that, you know, they're going to have to fix some kind of thing. If you have China and India sending rockets up into space and going to the moon, they have their own projects. I don't think this kind of secrecy is going to hold under those circumstances. So my guess is that they are planning some type of public announcement around these things, but I don't think they're going to say, well, you know, we're dealing with UFOs and that they're alien cultures. I think that there definitely is something, though, coming up to that. And it's interesting because when we look at the secrecy around the JFK files, we have to go back to this and say, look, there's this NASA aspect. There's JFK wanting to share these things with the Soviets and the public. There's Caddy's testimony about Hunt telling him the CIA assassinated Kennedy because he was giving our vital secret away, the alien presence. I mean, it is really a snowball of factors. And, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post want you to fight about, well, was Oswald really a communist? You know, and they want you to fight about, did the mafia get involved with the CIA? Which is something we found out 40 years ago. So, you know, we're not going for that smokescreen, but the trick is, how do you get a handle on what was actually going on? And I think a few people like Garrison, who was investigating the JFK assassination, figured out, like he said, the link between that and the aerospace wing. And I'm going to show this picture one more time, and I'll put it up at Dark Journalist, of course, but I'm just doing this for dramatic effect. Take a look at Inman and Janitis. Here's the garter of the UFO secret. Here's the garter of the Oswald secret. That's going to give us something of a link visually to everything else that we've been talking about tonight.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would really love to know everything that Bobby Ray Inman knows. I identified him when I, like, back in the 80s, I already knew, like, that guy knows everything.
Alexandra, I'm going to put you on the spot because I know when you were growing up in Brazil, you actually had a UFO sighting.
I did.
Can you just tell us that story real quick?
Yeah, I was with my neighbor. I'd been getting her tap dancing lessons. This was in Sao Paulo, which is, I think, the biggest city in the Western Hemisphere. And it's massive. There's like 20 million people there. And this bright red star was hovering over us, but it was behaving strangely, and it kept getting bigger and bigger. And she said, let's go get the binoculars. And we got the binoculars, and something weird happened there that was a sort of a classic abduction sort of thing happened. Her parents were asleep. In the tropics, the sun sets very abruptly every day. It sets at pretty much the same time, around 6 p.m. Doesn't change very much. And it, you don't have these long sunsets. It goes from light to dark very quickly. And so suddenly, like, the dark had snuck up on us, and everything was dark. The inside of the house was dark. There was some people were working in the kitchen, but when we got to her parents' bedroom, they were dead asleep as if they were in a coma.
Wow. And
I just couldn't believe that we were in their bedroom with her parents asleep. She's rumbling around in the closet and finds these Zeiss lens binoculars. And we go back outside, and as we were going back outside, my knees were shaking, and my legs almost collapsed out from under me. I was terrified. I did not want to go back out there and see this thing. And it had come down even further. You could see it was a cylindrical object. It was actually a flashlight-shaped object. It had maybe a satellite dish on one end of it.
Wow.
Scaffolding, like superstructure with red lights on the scaffolds. And it sort of rolled, and you could see, you know, that it was a dual superstructure sort of thing going on with it. That, you know, as it rolled, like the different armatures would obscure the lights as it moved. You know, it was very 3D, very with layered, and it was in a vertical position, and then it got down on its side and then went that way, and. Wow. Yeah, it actually sort of looked similar to something in the stuff coming off of it, the lights. It reminded me of things from Close Encounters. But the shape was actually, I haven't even heard of a shape like a flashlight-shaped object. I've never heard of another account of that. But the following week in school, I told a few people, and somehow the one person who I told, he said that his mother had seen the exact same thing from the opposite side of town. So from 20 miles away.
Wow.
In her penthouse, she saw the same object.
You know what always grabs me about this story is that the parents are asleep.
Yeah.
Her parents, you know, because it's in the afternoon, isn't it?
Well, that's what we've, you know, exactly. It got dark very rapidly, and suddenly they looked like it was 4 o'clock in the morning, like they were dead asleep. We were in the room. They didn't wake up. They didn't make a sound when we were in there rummaging around in their closet with the light on, you know, going right onto their bed. And I just thought, this is so awkward. I can't believe this.
And so interesting.
This was all part of, you know, when I went to see Dr. Mack, and he regressed me to try to see what he could find about this story, and didn't find anything.
It's almost like you had kind of a shut off thing there that he couldn't get past. That was my impression anyway.
That was my impression. You know, I certainly wanted to hear more, like what happened, what really happened, but that's all I ever found out.
It's pretty fascinating. When you look back at Mack's work and the kind of respectability that he gave to the topic, you know, long before the whole Gaia TV type stuff came along, what do you see? You know, how do you rank the work and what he was trying to do?
Very much a scientist. I mean, he was a materialist, but he was also into transpersonal psychology. And this, he was very much bringing his background in transpersonal psychology into his study of this. And yes, I think he was seeing something transcendent, something that transcended his scientific paradigm. You know, he was seeing something that was, it was transcendent. And so he was exciting to him because it was taking him to places he had never been.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
And I think that his, you know, he regressed and spoke to enough people to be satisfied that this was real in some way. And then he coined a term called the imaginal realm to talk about, because he didn't only just study abductees. In fact, I still have some friends who were introduced to me by his assistant, who they were having their dream world was incredibly powerful, and they were having some kind of a real, like their dream world was really interpolating on their physical world. They were having these very intense dreams, and they were actually able to communicate back and forth between their dream and physical lives and sort of shape their lives with their dreams. It was very interesting.
Wow.
And then I became part of the story, of their story, for a while. But they almost had two movies made by Oliver Stone. So that was interesting.
And their lives are very interesting.
Yeah, Oliver Stone was a big figure in their dream life.
That's so interesting. The one of the things that I see about Mack is that he compared, toward the end of his life, the near-death experience with the abduction experience. And he was saying, you're going into some kind of a different realm of understanding. And he was really on the front lines, you know, when there were these incredible contact cases. Like, he went to South Africa when there were these 26 school children. And that's a fascinating documentary that's on YouTube, and I recommend people check it out.
Oh, yeah, I've run it. I have it on my channel.
Oh, it's on Forbidden Knowledge TV. Go there instead. ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net, which you can find the best documentaries there. I spent so much time on your site. But it is interesting because it takes that kind of approach. You know, it's a sort of fearless approach, and he gave away all of his credentials, of course, or he risked them all. And there were elements that were trying to take him down. And interestingly enough, Daniel Sheehan, who, you know, pops up in the story a lot, who was a lawyer and a political activist, he actually said that they were very curious who was really doing behind the push, trying to get Mack out of Harvard University for talking about UFOs and trying to regress people and really move.
Yeah, he was, Dan Sheehan was his lawyer at that time.
Right, exactly.
And he's also, interestingly, a lawyer. He represented the Jesuits in several cases.
Wow, that's pretty wild. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because what he said when he discovered was that it wasn't the government that was trying to shut Mack down per se. It was Time Magazine.
Wow.
That's why it's this thing resides not only in government, it sits inside of that media structure. And I found that particularly interesting because Time Magazine decided, you know, to take it upon themselves to do this. And there's so much in Time Magazine. When you look at, if you go back to Time Life and the cover of Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, where they pasted the head on before Photoshop and showed him holding a rifle and sold that to the American people in 1964. What amazes me is that these people are still trying to do the same thing, and it's 50 years later, and they're thinking that we haven't discovered new tools to see through that kind of simple brainwashing. It's interesting, you know, when I was talking to Linda Moulton Howe, and she was telling me, well, you know, when they try to train me as a newscaster in the early 70s, the rule was treat the audience like they're an eighth grader, and she objected. But I find it interesting that that was one of those hardcore principles that they had in there. And that not only are they thinking talk down to an eighth grader, but also, you know, kind of herd them into a particular reality. So we see people like Woolsey coming out and saying, oh, yeah, well, Oswald may have had help in the JFK assassination, but he was a KGB agent, not a CIA agent.
It's like
cover-up structure kind of comes clear for me.
Everything that in that statement is not even wrong. It's just bad. It's like, but yeah, I would say that sort of the Kardashians is a great example of, you know, really just herding people into a stupid cul-de-sac, mm-hmm. you know, and just here, look at this big butts, you know?
Well, I would always say it can't end on a note like that. It's been great having you on here. I'm going to just really summarize a couple of the points that we made, and we'll take a couple of questions. But, you know, basically the points from the records are this. The things that they put out about Martin Luther King's sex life, nobody cares about. And that's no revelation, and the media has nothing when they talk about that. That's one. Two, the Mexico City Oswald case, there's zero. And let's see, how low is zero? Zero is zero. Zero evidence for Lee Oswald in Mexico City talking to the Soviet or Cuban embassies. Never happened. It's a CIA dream. The Garrison files, they're still secret. They did not come out with this batch. They have not been released. They have, you know, they reveal the details of the CIA surveillance of Garrison, but they may also contain Garrison looking into the NASA aerospace aspect of the assassination. And that may be crucial. And that may be one of the reasons they want to keep those documents completely out of the public realm, not to mention the shenanigans that they pulled against Garrison. And finally, Bobby Ray Inman and George Genetes. Genetes being the psychological warfare operator who ran the Oswald op, and Inman being the disclosure, quasi-disclosure deputy CIA director who said, well, you know, we did reverse engineer craft from these crash retrievals. I think all these points together let us know that in terms of secrecy, we're in one of the worst states ever. You know, we're really in a complete wall of secrecy. That's the way they'd like to maintain it. And the only thing that's breaking it down is our own research, because the media sure ain't helping.
Well, the media, you know, you have to get it out of your mind that they're there to do anything except for control you. I mean, they're not there to be nice and give you information that's useful. That's not what they're about.
Absolutely. I would totally agree. Let's take a few questions, and we'll wrap up here in the next few minutes. But it's great, by the way, to have everyone here. And if you have any questions, I have a question for you before we get into it even, which is, you've seen a lot. You've written over 6 books. You've written extensively about the New Age movement. You've written about UFOs. You've written about the development of spiritualism. You wrote a book about 2012 when that craze was happening and you were examining it from the outside. How do you see, where are we now in terms of the UFO research at this point? Here it is, 70 years after they splurched, kind of lurched on the scene and really splashed in everyone's imagination. You know, where are we now in terms of the UFO question?
Well, I guess we were talking sort of about the ebb and flow, I guess, over the course of administrations or something, of how, you know, it looks like there's going to be disclosure and then it pulls back. So I think we saw sort of what was almost going to be disclosure in the 90s and pulled back during Bush 2. And I think it's kind of moving back into maybe disclosure again. It's starting to move back into that direction. It's what it sort of feels like. It's the topic is being discussed again. There were many years where it just disappeared.
True. It is very unusual. Yeah, it seems like they're looking at some type of, even that term disclosure has become ridiculous because the government's never going to disclose anything real in relation to the alien factor.
Oh, not in relation to JFK either.
Exactly. And that's about the state of the state, right?
Yeah, we got like a hit piece on MLK that was done back then. It's meaningless. And basically what that document is more, it's interesting because it reveals how they do smear campaigns or something.
Right, right.
It's destructive on that level.
Right, exactly. How does the FBI and CIA get together to tear down a public figure? I guess that could be the name of that file.
Right, exactly.
The way that's being covered, I mean, it's just embarrassing. Okay, so we'll take a couple of questions. Here's one. And by the way, Groovy Bean is out there. And I said this at the very beginning to myself. I said, well, if we have anyone from three-letter agencies using four-letter words, we have a five-star spam troll general out there, and it's Groovy Bean, so thank you. Occult Priestess says, is the Upside Down the fourth dimension, a ghost realm, Bardo, Hades, another dimension?
Yeah, I would. That's pretty good.
Yeah. But
I think, the Bardo, as I understand it, is more like an in-between, and I think the Upside Down is an in-between, and I guess maybe that's what 4D, that people did the usage, also the imaginal realm, which is the term that John Mack used. So I think that there might be something that's in between the material, the physical, and 4D, and maybe that's what the Upside Down is, and that's what in the Bardo. The Bardo, as I understand it from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is sort of where you go right after you die, when you're like in a transition phase. Now, other people refer to 4D as a transition place itself. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. I mean, I don't really have a map. I'm not really a master of these realms, so it's hard. But yeah, you're in the right neighborhood, I think.
You've got a pretty active imagination. That's very interesting, actually. What I always do is I go through these different things about it, because when Theosophy came out, they talked about the astral plane, and everybody understood, oh, dreams come from here, and you can astral project, and all these different things. And then people started talking about the ethereal realm and the ethereal body, which was supposed to be like a body double, and how you could actually heal the ethereal body. And a lot of like Mesmer's research was around this. So it is very fascinating when you get into what the terms actually mean. But certainly I think that the astral space would be akin to the dream realm.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
And it's sort of the place where the UFO phenomenon occurs.
Right. Well, this is very fascinating. When I talked to Graham Hancock, you know, he's not a big supporter around the whole idea of UFOs and all the rest of it. But I said, you know, let's get into UFOs a little bit. And he said, well, you know, the oddest thing is the only time I've ever seen a gray is when I was doing an ayahuasca.
I was going to say that, like, people who do ayahuasca see grays. So
what does that tell you, though? I mean, it is kind of fascinating. It means that these beings, just like shamans would see these beings, they exist in these different realms. But here we are in our particular era, and we're seeing them crash land, and, you know, people see them on fire, and, you know, you look through the craft thing, and there's a bunch of praying mantis aliens in there. I mean, it's very interesting because it seems like if they operate in this ethereal realm, why is the military carting away their craft and stuff?
Which hardware, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like there's two aspects to this,
yeah.
or a spectrum of these things.
Yes, exactly. But it's a great question, and Occult Priestess tends to ask excellent questions. There's a lot of great questions in here, and they're flying by. Let's see if I can catch some of this. I'm going to employ the magic keyboard and see if we can get back. Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, How does MKUltra and COINTELPRO affect the masses these days?
Well, LA shooting, the Las Vegas shooting. And
yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'd say that there's a lot more EMKUltra. That is entrainment technology being employed through smartphone devices, through modems, and, you know, this kind of thing. I really think that the EMKUltra is their real kind of pride and joy now because it's easy to affect a mass.
Because I know Catherine Austin Fitz talks about entrainment and how it's deployed, but I want to hear more about yours and her ideas, if you know hers, of what the objectives are, what they trigger people to actually do, think, and feel.
Well, it's an excellent point. And we could do a whole show on entrainment. One of the things I know that Fitz is working on in relation to this is what she called the 2016 the Kingsman campaign. And the Kingsman is that movie where this programmer has developed this app and it makes all these people violent with each other. And she's looked at a number of incidents where violence has broken out. One of her favorite ones that she focuses on is this Chuck E. Cheese incident, where all these people just out of the blue start freaking out on each other. And that's the kind of entrainment, I think, that she's really referring to, which is, you know, it's dangerous. And it's the kind of thing where whenever they need a good distraction op, they'll employ it. But the whole idea behind entrainment, it's very layered. And I think even in the work of Rupert Sheldrake, when the things that he talks about these different feels that we generate when we have conversations and, you know, when we look at each other in the eyes and all this type of morphogenic feels that get developed, that the entrainment is meant to break it, that you're supposed to look at your phone and break the interaction with the other person, and it makes you more subjugated to this kind of centralizing voice telling you what to do, whether it's what to buy or what to vote for, or finally, you know, what stories to follow up on and what things to accept, you know, like,
what
GMOs are great.
You know, sound, you're a sound engineer, you know that stuff really well. And you know how when you have a very powerful sound, it'll make the other peripheral ones sync up and line up to the frequencies.
Yes.
More powerful one, and that's what entrainment means, or certainly brainwave entrainment. It gets your brainwave to entrain to the dominant frequency. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
To get your brainwaves to get entrained onto the one that they're trying to get you on, and get your brains to sync up to the frequency that they're trying to sync you up to. And
right.
My question was, is it just about buying, or is it about believing whatever their story du jour is? You know, that, I was just wondering what, because she talks about it's entrainment, but she's very vague about exactly what the entrainment, what the goal, you know, what the target is.
Right. You got a good question, a couple here. One of them is about, what are your views on the Moon and Mars colonies outposts by the military, just a Corey Good related hoax? Well, that stuff was around way before Good and any of the stuff that he ever talked about. But no, I think that they've had a large scale program in space. And I think that that program has been shut out a few times by something. And we can conjecture pretty easily that it's off world civilizations keeping an eye on us. But the truth is, there's no real factual evidence of a war in space. I would say that we've seen, you know, there are these films from NASA which show us shooting at something. And I think that we've tried to employ these types of tactics. But I think that on the other side, whatever it is that's flying around, and there's incredible research around, you know, Grays, Pleiadians, and everything else. But whatever it is that's flying around, they outmaneuver anything that we have by a factor of 1,000 at least. So I would think our attempts to do things like that are pretty primitive. There was another question, and this is very interesting. It was, do you think that John Mack went in with an open mind, or was he going in to debunk the subject and became converted? And I think it's pretty true that coming where he was coming from, he was a good candidate to be a debunker, actually. Quite the opposite of a promoter.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what got him there. I think I forgot what the story was that what got him into the abduction phenomenon. Do you know that story?
It was Hopkins. And it was Hopkins, you know, his stories and people saying you've got to check out Hopkins and see the work that he's up to, and John being really skeptical that there's this weird artist somewhere, you know, regressing people and using this kind of do-it-yourself hypnosis to do it. But he got hooked on the whole process and opened up his consciousness quite a bit. I think he's an unusual man. When I met him, what I was struck by was his actual presence. He was very, it's almost like you became more aware just being around him. And some people have that type of effect. But he was a very aware, tuned in individual and, you know, very kind of calm, I would say, in a lot of ways, but intense, you know, that was my impression. So he certainly, you know, he was very tuned in. You know, I call that kind of like a psychic persona, whatever you want to call it, but that's something he certainly had. Okay, a couple more questions. And you know, if you sent a question and we missed it, you can go ahead and repost it because it's tricky sometimes. Yeah. David Jacobs scares me. Well, no. Jacobs is probably one of the best, but his stories about what aliens are up to, it's pretty scary. I agree with you there. The seance in Maine in 1952, Poharic groups of beings calling themselves the Nine. Well, that's a really interesting one, very obscure. I would have to say that there was a lot of this activity at the time, which almost recalls the kind of seance craze of the 1850s, but instead people started channeling aliens, you know, and I guess that topped off in the 80s when people were doing it. But I do think that the Nine and, you know, this whole type of idea of a council I've seen come up over and over again. And I think the truth about channeling is that there are real channels who can get to this information. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. It seems, you know, you have so many people coming out with that particular structure. And so I think it's real somewhere. I don't know if it's good or I don't think it's something maybe that you want to be involved with particularly. you know, it's not just because an entity can hijack somebody's body and describe their reality, maybe in a manipulative way, makes them positive beings. My general sense is that any being that's going to be hijacking another body to communicate with you is negative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, you get back to intention on a lot of those questions again. Those are a lot of really good questions, actually. I appreciate it. I want to remind everyone that there's going to be two more of these special reports on the JFK files leading up to the special I'm doing on November 22nd on the JFK assassination. Also, I have a really big announcement between now and the 22nd, so stay tuned to Dark Journals. I can't give it to you now. But it's probably coming out in about a week or so. And it's pretty interesting. It'll be very, very interesting for everyone. So keep that on your calendar. And also, I have some interviews coming up. There's an interview coming up with Alexandra about her Montauk work, which I think is very interesting. And there'll be some very, very interesting surprises around the JFK story and the JFK file story in the next 2 weeks. So you heard it here first. The only other thing I would like to mention is that the SSP and COG episodes will start up again after the JFK anniversary is over. And that's something I'm very committed to doing. It's a 4-part series. And we've got 3 episodes left, and we'll probably have Alexandra on for one of those too. Alexandra, it's great to have you back. Thanks so much for being on.
Love hanging out. Look forward to the next one.
And of course, it's ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net. You're doing stories. You have stories there every day, and you're writing essays for everything that you run. And there's videos there. There's all these different categories. I don't know if there is a site that has as many categories.
Yeah, there's like 100 categories. It's like almost 5,000 pages. It's a library. I just fixed all the broken links, so it's all clean and it's like a library. It's a resource. There's a lot of, somebody called it the Library of Alexandra.
It's pretty incredible. It is pretty incredible. And you are, you know, with your own writing, I guess, just because you're such a great writer. Of course, you've done 6 books already. I've told you to do a book on CERN, which I think should be your next book. But it is interesting because I think that we see that on the internet generally, which is you don't get that quality of writing. It's tricky. Very often you don't. And you're an excellent writer. And I think that's what really drives the site, along with the way that you curate the videos. So it's an excellent site. And I spend so much time and get so much education from watching the videos that you do.
Thank you. I enjoy doing it. My life work a little bit.
Yes absolutely. So that's ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net. Everyone subscribe there. It's free, and it's a free newsletter. Unbelievable. I'd also recommend you go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for the newsletter so you stay updated on these episodes. And I'll let you know in the newsletter when things are happening. Like I said, big announcement in the next 2 weeks, and I want to make sure you get it first. So make sure you're on the newsletter for that. And I really appreciate everyone coming out. Thank you, Groovy Bean. You did a great job. And of course, Groovy Bean's channel, she's doing a lot more now. And everyone should check that out also. So thanks so much. And we're going to get deeper into the JFK files over the next 2 weeks. So have a great evening over there. Bye-bye. Oh, that's over and out. Hitler died of old age in Argentina. I agree with that.
Oh, yeah. Who said that?
That is a very informed commentator.
Oh, yeah. That is, you know, that's what I remember. I met somebody who met the guy who knows for sure that that's what happened.
That is a good story. And we're going to have to tell that one. If we don't make a documentary out of it, we'll make an episode out of it.
In Argentina, see Mengele's suitcase. He wants money, though.
I bet. I just bet.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. And we'll talk soon. Bye-bye. And bye, Alexander.
Bye.
Ciao.